You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. But many thanks to Kevin Peters for the last 2 hours. But now at 12 p.m, it's time for the second of the Bums on Seats Cambridge Film Festival specials. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio this afternoon are Hannah Dunleavy.
Hello.
Mark Livicic.
Good afternoon.
Gavin Midgley.
Hello.
And Owen Baker.
Hello.
After 9 full days of films, today's programme is a deep breath before heading back into the dark, a catch-up of some of the strongest and strangest movies that have been screened or are still to screen during the festival. Cate Blanchett is the New York socialite whose world shatters into 1,000 pieces when her husband is convicted of fraud in Blue Jasmine, Woody Allen's tale of spiralling despair and self-delusion. We get a glimpse of promising UK filmmakers with a quick review of arranged marriage drama Horror and romantic comedy Dead Cat, both of which have screened this week. And we judge the merits of the 1970s questionable fondness for mixing lurid horror and saucy seaside postcard nudity with Horror Hospital, part of the festival's bewitching strand of micro cinema. And also, after last year's showcase of Catalonian cinema, the season has returned with a tighter focus on new filmmakers and a final farewell to the late Bigas Luna. With such a strong showing of Catalonian cinema on the verge of the bizarre, we talked to programmer Ramona Lamarca about the connection between the surreal of Spanish cinema, old and new. And we talked to Neil McGlone, researcher for A Story of Children in Film, the new cinema documentary from Mark Cousins, which helps close the festival in high style on Sunday. That's all to come, but we begin the show by slowly going out of our minds.
He met me at a party and swept me off my feet.
I fell in love with the name Jasmine.
No, I have never been to San Francisco. I'll be staying with my sister.
Jasmine! Oh my God.
Look at you.
Your place is homey.
Oh, the flight was bumpy.
The food was awful.
I mean, you'd think first class.
I thought you were tapped out.
I'm dead broke. Really, I mean, the government took everything.
Is there anything you want that you don't have?
Sweetheart, it's beautiful.
When your sister had all that money, she wanted nothing to do with you. Now that she's broke, all of a sudden, she's moving in.
She's not just broke. She's all screwed up.
Cool off, you know? You hear me, Hal?
Excuse me. Are you talking to me?
Virginia just told me all about you. One minute you're on top of the world, the next, guy turns out to be a crook.
You'll be very happy to know that I lost every cent of my own money.
Her husband was a slick operator. I was there a week. I knew the guy was hitting on a girlfriend.
Anxiety, nightmares, and a nervous breakdown. There's only so many traumas a person can withstand till they take to the streets and start screaming.
The last decade or so of Woody Allen's career has been characterized by the sadly Sisyphean task of keeping in filmmaking form. For every Match Point, there's a Scoop. For every Vicky Cristina Barcelona, there's a Whatever Works. For every Midnight in Paris, there's a From Rome with Love. In keeping with this good, bad, then good again, seasick motion, Allen's latest film, Blue Jasmine, has been met with rave reviews and strong box office. Cate Blanchett plays the title character, Jeanette Francis. The Jasmine is a nickname that seems that is the first of many affectations. Once she lived an indulgent life as a trophy wife to Alec Baldwin's high-flying city executive. Her every whim was catered for, her New York evenings a rush of parties, her long, bright days filled with the illusion of being busy and doing good. But her husband's riches came from double dealings, bribes and backhanders, and when the law finally catches up with him, Jasmine loses everything. Her only safety net is her adopted sister Ginger, Sally Hawkins, a blue-collar worker with a line of muscle men boyfriends and a tiny apartment in San Francisco. Woody Allen's script and unusually adventurous direction creates a narrative that flips backwards and forwards between Jasmine's lap of luxury marriage and, from her point of view, the almost impossible life she has ungraciously fallen into. Gavin, Woody Allen has always, since the very beginning of his career, really, since the mid-70s certainly, moved between comedies and dramas. But even by his usual dramatic inclinations, and this is a career that includes You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger, Blue Jasmine is a bleak, bleak picture.
It is. It's funny in the way that it doesn't really resolve any of that bleakness. It's not to say that there aren't laughs throughout the film's running time, because there are laughs, and some of them are black, you know, it's sort of a black humour, and some of them are quite nervous laughs, but they are funny. But the overall tone, as you say, is quite a dark one, and it's a difficult one to resolve, because you're never quite sure if what his point is, if it's going to come to a happy resolution, or if it's simply a descent into... the main issue he's tackling is mental illness, and it comes quite clear that Kate Blanchett's character is suffering quite badly.
I think we can dig deeper than that. It becomes certainly, and maybe this is the point of not the twist, but the way the backstory resolves itself, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is it's not mental illness, it's self-inflicted mental illness, because she believes she deserves something that she doesn't deserve. Well, she had no authentic right to, not that anybody has an authentic right to riches, but once that she's lost that, she falls apart. I think that's the bigger criticism here, and actually that's the part that plays quite well to the banking crisis of 2008 and 2009. A lot of people moaning about their extravagant lifestyles suddenly becoming normal lifestyles. So she hasn't lost. She's lost an extravagant lifestyle. She's fallen into a perfectly friendly and comfortable lifestyle that she just cannot accept. I think that comes first and foremost above the mental disintegration is due to her inability to take that in.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. And her sort of lifestyle and her character's trajectory is contrasted with that of her sister, Sally Hawkins, who doesn't appear to have those problems. There's certainly not those mental problems, but she seems to have problems of her own. Her relationship with her boyfriend, which sort of fluctuates throughout the course of the plot, doesn't necessarily come to a happy conclusion either, I would argue. And yet, on the surface, she seems to be happier. As you say, she doesn't have the materialistic sort of luxuries that Kate Blanchett's character has. But I don't think it's a simple attack on capitalism or indeed the banking crisis.
I don't believe it's yeah, I think Woody Allen's aware that he's raising those issues in the background. I don't think that's primarily what the film's about. Hannah, when we were discussing on the show last year or the year before that, whenever that long Woody Allen documentary was released, we reached the conclusion that whilst his comedies have always obviously been groundbreaking and hugely important, his serious films have always, even when they're good, they're always aping something else. They're always aping something European, Bergman or something. They never seem to be quite true to himself.
Right.
But to me, I was surprised. I'm not going to leave you just with that.
Okay.
But with Blue Jasmine, I was surprised how can I turn this into a question? How strong and the central drama was. I was surprised not how the bleakness, but how un-Woody Allen it felt, actually.
Well, I would say it appeared to me that he was aping Tennessee Williams. It's got a very strong A Streetcar Named Desire thread throughout it, I think. Not least demonstrated in the fact of how absolutely, completely sweaty Kate Blanchett is in it all the time. I don't think I've ever seen an actress quite so sweaty on screen all the time, which seems to speak to some sort of southern sort of steaminess that Tennessee Williams had.
I think it's because I felt finally, and maybe Owen can come in on this, but I felt that this was one of his few recent dramas of the last 15 years, say, certainly since Crimes and Misdemeanors, possibly, which could sit alongside the work he reveres so much. He'd balk at that, I'm sure. You didn't think the laughs and the drama balanced themselves? The lack of laughs, really.
I think the more I thought about the film since I saw it earlier in the week, and the more I think there's a lot to respect about it. I think Woody Allen said at some point, and this is a sort of second-hand quote, but that making good films is easy, or making films is easy. You get a good good actors, a good script, and beautiful settings. And I think I'm almost disappointed how true that appears to be. I think the performances in this are universally very good, but Cate Blanchett is obviously the sort of central core of it and is extraordinary. And the script is pretty good. You know, the direction, he's obviously talented, and some of the settings are amazing, and it's certainly a side of a part of America you don't necessarily always see. But I just found it too depressing. And I'm not someone who is particularly averse to a depressing film. I quite like a depressing film. And I'm also very aware that Woody Allen's made interesting dramas in the past, and that he doesn't always go for sort of all-out comedy, and that's fine. But there were periods in this film where I would say it's irrefutable that the audience I was in it with didn't know whether it was supposed to be, bits of it were supposed to be funny or not.
Is that the film? No, absolutely.
But I think there are points where Woody Allen didn't know. I felt like there were elements of this where things become a little absurd, and absolutely that's a consequence of her mental kind of disintegration, and I understand that, but I just found it so relentlessly bleak and sort of hopeless that I was just depressed by it.
I think when you say about the comedy thing, it doesn't help that it actually has a phenomenal amount of people that are traditionally associated with comedy, yes, not least two stand-ups,
yeah,
in it.
Yeah.
But I never actually thought I would say anything positive about Andrew Dice Clay in my life, but he's actually really good in it.
He's amazing.
As is Louis Suquet. And of course Alec Baldwin, who is hilarious when he wants to be. So it did feel like at some point it might break out and become funny. A funny character might emerge, and it may.
And then it even actually, and I think this is perhaps not proof that Woody Allen is aware of the line he's treading, and he's that he's deliberately walking and then constantly deliberately falls onto the dramatic side, is that Sally Hawkins, who's I think as good as Cate Blanchett,
yes,
in a less showy role, is the light at the end of the tunnel for so much of the film, and then he allows that to be extinguished as well, or at least, you know, she sinks, yeah, into her own problems, which she's got nobody to turn to, and you realise that what she ends up with is a compromise, and that her sister's...
Although I think the Bobby Cannavale character himself is quite confused. It can't quite seem to make up whether he's just an average guy that she's settling for, or whether he's actually quite an unpleasant guy, or whether he's actually quite a nice guy that's been kind of pushed to the point that he's at by the Cate Blanchett character. So that seems quite confused. I mean, it is lifted by its cast. I would say it's actually quite so-so from a script point of view. It does seem to be, to me, lifted by its cast. I mean, the Peter Sarsgaard character, I mean, thank goodness for Peter Sarsgaard, because otherwise that character might as well have been called Mr. Plot Device, I think. He doesn't really have a great deal to do.
Well, he's especially in his dramas, in the well, to go back to Midnight in Paris, which obviously is not a drama, it's interesting, this, I'll come to Gavin on this, but it's his portrayal of women, and this is interesting compared to some of his recent work. He's written many, many strong female roles, but Midnight in Paris, he seemed to fall back on the simply shrew or muse, and that was it. And in this, he seems at first to be delivering more complicated female characters. It's not always, he shouldn't always have to, a writer shouldn't always have to, it shouldn't be balanced fairly, but when the film's about female characters, he should write them properly. There does seem to be more depth here, and I don't, again, is it in the script or is it in the direction? Because some of the blue collar, some of the alpha male characteristics that Hannah's just mentioned can be a bit broad again.
Yeah, and in fact, I was thinking about this earlier, that all the male characters are almost horrible. I mean, I think there's only one good male character who sort of seems to be a decent person, but even by the end, that's sort of thrown into question. So it's an interesting... He sort of flipped it, I think, in a sense. The female roles take centre stage, and they are, you know, both Cate Blanchett and Sally Hawkins run with them, because they're sort of given a wide breadth, you know, sort of a broad variety of opportunities to shine, to dig into themselves, to sort of reveal aspects of their character, and to be fully shaded, you know, fully rounded characters, in a sense. Whereas the male characters this time are much more thinly written, I think, and that's an interesting switch from some of his earlier films and from Hollywood films generally. Actually, I think it's nice to see something that's. Do something so differently.
It's nice to see something. There have actually been a number of films at every festival. There's a number of films that never make it to the cinemas, even the independent cinemas, that have more fully formed, fully rounded female characters. There's been some in this festival. Joe Swanberg's film, for instance, was spectacularly written female leads. But it's unusual in a film that, you know, opens wide, which this Woody Allen film does. Owen?
Yeah, I just wanted to very quickly say that I think what Gareth says is absolutely right, but I think it's more probably about working class male characters that Woody Allen seems. No way am I setting myself up as a sort of expert on Woody Allen's back catalogue, but he in this film definitely they are simplistic, and again I think they're saved by. The performances to some extent, but they're simplistic to the point of almost being caricature.
But he's
Bobby Cannavale's the exception, I think.
I think both of Sally Hawkins's her ex-husband, that Andrew Dice Clay character, yeah. And her new boyfriend, I think he gives enough depth there to say that to suggest that the film had been about them, it would have been equally interesting. They both get moments where yeah. The film, the film isn't taking Cate Blanchett's point of view that these are empty vessels and her adopted sister could do better. Mm. It just seems to be, and then every so often there are moments where it's saying they're just as worthwhile. It just isn't the film. The moment where the boyfriend cries in the supermarket is heartbreaking.
That's actually quite funny, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are some laughs there. whenever the character comes on with a broken heart, it's hilarious.
Yeah, exactly.
It never stops being funny, broken hearts. And the scene with Andrew Dice Clay on the street saying, you know, we can't just leave everything behind, which she constantly does. And there's another little scene where Sally Hawkins, I can't remember, I wrote in my notes, where she just gives a little look to something Cate Blanchett said, which just reveals lots and lots about her character. Mm. And yes, it's the acting, but it's also, I think we're being a bit unfair on Woody Allen, who's behind the camera saying, I would like you to do this. And this felt, after years of interesting but sloppy work, this felt a lot tighter. I thought the flashback structure was very well handled. And he actually seemed to have much more idea this time round what to do with composition. He seemed to take a lot more care in it.
It's very well crafted. I mean, definitely. I think perhaps I'm being a little bit harsh because you, although like you say, he has been sloppy of late. You know that Woody Allen is talented and, you know, more than competent. And yet, and this is definitely, and I would argue a bit like with Midnight in Paris. Actually, I think this is he has taken a great deal of care over this. And probably not least because the performances are so good that he's inclined to, because he knows that he's got gems there.
Are we, the final point, Hannah, are we being unfair, or not we in this room, but critics on a whole, everybody, this is Woody Allen's 46th film. He's in his mid-70s. He produces a film every year. It seems a bit unfair when you've got a back catalogue of masterpieces and classics and rubbish. Something Scoop's not very good. Whatever works has moments. That we expect every film. We seem to be the only ones concerned about the status of each individual film, and he isn't. He seems to have the right approach that I'll do what I do in it.
That's definitely true. I think from what I've read so far, if I read the words like a glorious return to form about Woody Allen one more time this week, I think I might just tear the newspaper up. Yeah, I think there is a certain degree of people saying, OK, you've hit this benchmark, now let's see. And
keep hitting and that almost, benchmark.
Yeah,
we sit here doing nothing like this.
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, if you...
The point is, a Woody Allen film is always worth seeing, though, isn't it? I mean, some are better than others, but there's always something in that. There's always a brilliant line or a great performance or some moment that always makes it worth watching, even if the overall result is disappointing. And it's only disappointing because it's measured against some, as you say, masterpieces. You know, I'm happy for him to keep delivering a film a year, even if the hit rate isn't as high as it might have been.
Next year's film, which I think finds him back in New York properly, is in San Francisco for most of this film. He might be a colossal disappointment, and everybody.
But if he can still keep attracting a cast of that caliber, then ideally they'll be able to lift. whatever
he,
he's
he always
got.
Does, because the cast knows somewhere along the line there'll be this film, there'll be these roles that he's written for them. Okay, all right, well, thank you, everybody. Blue Jasmine helped open the Cambridge Film Festival last week and is now screening at the Cineworld, whilst also it shall be opening at the Arts Picture House from Monday. It is a certificate 15, I believe. I did write it down. It is a certificate 12A, like almost everything in the world. Last year saw the release of the momentous Astoria film, Mark Cousins' 15-part, 900-minute exploration of global cinema. Not simply the acknowledged classics, but also the arenas of film that have been overlooked and haven't had the PR machine to lend them a helping hand onto the list of acknowledged masterpieces. Cousins' follow-up, A Story of Children in Film, isn't nearly as grand at first glance. It's only one part of 111 minutes, but more by accident than design, it is the first attempt to document how cinema has spent its first 100 years capturing the shifting, mercurial mood of children. I spoke to Neil McClone, who worked alongside Mark Cousins in researching, collecting and collating the vast amount of film clips used in the documentary. I asked him if such a project revealed patterns and themes in the manner cinema has represented children, and if sentimentality was an emotion that they had to shun or accept. But I began by wondering how the project had come about.
My niece and nephew, Laura and Ben, visited me in Edinburgh in Scotland, and so I filmed them. One shot, 12 minutes, no camera moves. Then I started chatting to people about making a film about kids and cinema. I've been interested in kids for a while. The first thing I ever directed for TV in 1989 was about a kids' festival in Glasgow. So I wrote an idea for a film about kids in movies.
A Story of Children and Film is more compact. It's not chronological. It focuses on children's moods. It's a kind of portrait of childhood, really, as seen through the moods of children. I guess that's the best way to describe it. I mean, Mark had been filming his niece and nephew, Ben and Laura, on his flip camera, and he was just watching it back one day and noticed these different moods and, you know, the different moods that children went through, and realised that there was something there. He put together a treatment, a pitch. I came involved with it around about the end of October last year, when Mark sent me an email which included the pitch, asking me if I'd be interested in being a researcher on the project.
Just a cursory look at the films that are depicted, as you would expect from Mark's previous work, this is the widest possible range of films you can imagine. Was it a case of him letting you loose and you finding things? Did you already have things in mind?
I've known Mark for about a couple of years, and really that was through the fact that I have my own kind of archive of films, which covers several thousand movies, which are not movies that you can pick up in the shop. So they're kind of like kind of rarer films that you're not going to be able to, you know, sort of buy on Amazon. But and from time to time, I would send Mark things that I thought would be of interest to him. So I guess he knew from my background there that it might be something that I could be of help with.
In such an artistic theme, rather, as expressions rather than depictions of certain things, what was the challenge of looking? How do you even begin to do that?
Initially, Mark had a timeline. He usually creates a kind of timeline when he's making a movie. And in this particular instance, he already had a set number of films in mind for the different areas that are featured in the film. And then it was more a case of, over a period of about 3 months, both he and I watched an awful lot of children's films. And not only just children's films, but films where they featured a main child protagonist. And it was during that we would go back and forth via email saying, you know, this, actually, we'll have a look at this. This could be good. And it was really a case of that. So it was about 3 months of watching a lot of movies, really.
But you must have had some sort of filtering process before that, especially with
absolutely. There was. I mean, there were certain things that we looked at. There was discussions over whether it was too obvious to include certain films, and I was perhaps of the opinion where I felt, well, it doesn't always matter just because it's obvious, you know, perhaps it still is relevant to, you know, to the theme. So some were certainly filtered out right from the beginning, which just didn't match up. And that's kind of how it went.
How abstract did you allow or the film structure to take? Are there chapter headings around these various themes that keep pulling it back? And
yes, there are. It does kind of start with his niece and nephew, Ben and Laura, and every so often it will come back to them to just bring you back to, you know, that that kind of reality, really. And you'll see that throughout the film. And there's also a scene towards the end where Mark does some filming in Scotland, and he's just talking then basically about what we've seen and what we haven't yet covered, or what you know, you don't always see through children, and things like nightmares and things like that, which obviously, you know, is not something he would film, you know, of his niece and nephew. And then we look at some films which cover, you know, children's imagination as well, you know, and like flying and, you know, stuff like that.
When you've got all of this material in front of you, whether it's in the edit or in the pre-production, do certain other patterns emerge? Do you start to see how Eastern Europe or Asian cinema treats its younger characters compared to American cinema, or American cinema in the last 30 years is different from American cinema 60 or 70 years ago?
Yes, you're right. I mean, you can see in the film from the different clips that are used. You've got some clips from Iranian cinema, which, you know, looks at children and, you know, has perhaps almost a kind of harsh way of looking at children, you know. And then you look at, you know, something like, there's a clip in there from like Meet Me in St. Louis, which, you know, is a musical, and it's all, you know, back to that, you know, golden Hollywood period. And so, yeah, there are quite stark contrasts.
Did you come across different depictions and treatments of sentimentality? Because I would imagine that was something that wasn't of interest to the film itself, but something you can't escape with different cultures.
It's difficult. I mean, again, sentimentality is sometimes perhaps objective, you know, into how you perceive it. And I guess perhaps there are some clips in there where you could say that, you know, okay, that is a bit sentimental. But again, I guess I'd go back to if it fits the criteria and works, then why not include it, you know?
Can you see my hand?
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Neil for speaking to me over an intermediate Skype connection. He'll be visiting the Arts Picture House this Sunday to introduce the screening, which begins at 8:45 and may be found on page 31 of the festival brochure. You can also find out a great deal more about the film, as well as trailers and videos of the making of the film and Mark Cousins' notes, by visiting their website, which, typically enough, is www.astoryofchildreninfilm.com.
Missed one of your favourite shows? Well, don't despair. Head over to Cambridge105.fm, where you can download a selection of show podcasts, featuring regular podcasts from our business programme In Your Company, film reviews from Bums on Seats, everything that's tasty and refreshing with our food and drink show, Flavour, plus replays of guest interviews from 105 Breakfast and 105 Drive. There's something on offer for everyone. Get downloading now at Cambridge105.fm.
Keep up to date with all the latest sporting action on 105 Sport every Saturday afternoon from 4. Join me, Chris Stewarden, and the rest of the 105 Sports team for latest news, conference and Premier League goals as they go in, special features on local sports clubs, and plenty of controversial insight and opinion on the previous 7 days in world sport. Plus, throughout the football season, we'll be broadcasting live from the Arkostings Abbey Stadium for all of Cambridge United Saturday home games. We'll have fans forums, player interviews, post-match reports, and of course live second half commentary on the U's throughout the season.
What a goal from Cunnington in the first minute.
That's 105 Sport, live from 4 till 6 p.m. every Saturday, right here on Cambridge 105.
Broadcasting from the best part of Britain.
Cambridge 105. You're listening to the Cambridge Film Festival special of Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city with me, Tubby Miller, and in the studio this morning, Hannah Dunleavy, Gavin Midgley, Mark Livesich, and Owen Baker. This show and the podcast we've been releasing throughout the past week have had a tendency to concentrate on the rare chance the film festival offers to see cinema from the four corners of the globe. But it also offers an important first step for UK filmmakers. A festival well enough known becomes a brand or marketing collateral that a new movie can use to create word of mouth, positive buzz, and intrepid distributor, and possibly, though it can take years in some depressing cases, a wide release. Mark, I'm going to have to be brief on this, unfortunately, but you've seen two. You saw Honor last night and Dead Cat earlier in the week, and you've had long conversations with the director of Dead Cat, a romantic comedy that is searching for distributor. These are two UK films which you normally wouldn't get to see if it wasn't for the film festival environment, and really.
Honor is a particular hot topic at the moment, the situation of Asian families who put honour even above the lives of their own family members. In this case, hire Paddy Considine as a hitman to come in and track down a family member who's run away for fear of her own life. And it tackles such a difficult topic in a fascinating way and does it with what's almost a thriller very effectively. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got Dead Cat, which is, once you get past the slightly unusual title, is actually a very fresh, light and funny romantic comedy drama, which again does something particularly rare in making the London settings that it uses feel quite contemporary and you know, streets that you would walk down yourself. But the characters don't have the sort of perfections in them. They haven't got the rough edges sanded away, so consequently it's a film that actually feels genuine, if I can actually use that word. So for whatever reason, both of these films I think are going to struggle to get a wider audience, simply because they get lost in the wealth of Hollywood product. Consequently, the exposure they can get from festivals like this, this was the UK premiere of Honor, it's out in January. Dead Cat is currently doing the festival rounds, showed in at Film in Mexico yesterday, as well as showing here. And those are the lengths that the filmmakers are forced to go to because, unfortunately, they can't get the support from the likes of our own film industry.
Owen, you've also saw Dead Cat, which enjoyed three screenings over the festival, each one increasingly, you know, more populated due to the word of mouth. Is this the sort of film that I mean, we're constantly bemoaning the status of British films that reach the cinema, and and is this, I mean, you enjoyed it, Dead Cat, but do you think there'll be an opportunity to see that again outside the festival circuit, and you wish there was?
I certainly wish there was. I think it was it's at the same time really interesting and very funny. I mean, until I saw The Man Whose Brain Exploded last night, this was comfortably the funniest film I'd seen at the festival so far. But it's also very accessible. It's not in any way the sort of film that, you know, that if you like a non-picture house goer would find difficult. It's not, you know, there's no kind of film snobbery with Dead Cat. It's a very funny, very accessible, beautiful in a lot of ways. There's lots of beauty in it. It's really, but like Mark says, also very realistic. You know, it doesn't drop into the kind of very tried and tested sort of romantic comedy little tricks and things. It's really very good. I mean, up there with anything I've seen this year in terms of romantic comedy, which I see a surprisingly large amount. It was really very good, and it's a great shame that they, I mean, it'll be very sad if it doesn't get any kind of national release, and it's a huge shame that it even struggles to. You know, it doesn't seem necessary.
It's a minefield. This time last, or the show after this in the festival last year, we finished the festival off myself and Jim Ross with a screening of Ashes, which is from the director of the Stone Roses, not the documentary, but a Stone Roses film that was going to come out later in the year as well, Spike Island film. Neither of which, either a Spike Island film or Ashes, which had Ray Winston in it, it still didn't get why, and a good Ray Winston, not the Sweeney Ray Winston. Would I say that if he was here? Neither of them got proper releases, or any release at all.
And again, you go back to 2 years ago, the Dimensions film that two local filmmakers, Ant and Sloan, put together. It's just been classified for DVD. You know, they've been trying for 2 years to get that. It's had a lot of success, won awards at festivals, yet again, if you've not got the backing or the support of the industry as a large behind you, it's almost impossible to get your product into a wider release.
Okay, well, we're going to be covering this more through the partnership we have with Take One, because we have, you did an interview with the director of Dead Cat, Stefan Giorgio, and we'll be transcribing that and getting that published the week or two after the festival, and looking more and promoting that film and other of these films, helping at least create a body of, as I said earlier, marketing collateral behind it, which is these films need anything to get more word of mouth out. Okay, you are listening to the Cambridge Film Festival special Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in Cambridge. Last year's film festival saw a welcome arrival for a strand of new Catalonian cinema. The autonomous Spanish state has enjoyed a recent flourishing of adventurous filmmaking since Franco's death ended the restrictions and censorship on artists and writers. Now the region's films, from thrillers to comedies to political dramas, account for a sizable percentage of the full Spanish box office. This year has seen Catalonian cinema make a return visit with four films that give an idea of the growing inventiveness of the movies being produced. New release The Forest, which dares to introduce an air of dark magic into the start of the Spanish War, the emotional drama Redemption of the Fishes, and 2008's documentary Eyes on the Sky, a strange dreamlike evocation of the 1938 aerial bombardment of Barcelona. Plus, there's been a chance to see Anguish, the 1987 feature from the recently deceased Vigas Luna. Steve Williams, a regular writer for Take One, sat down with Ramon Lamarca, the gentleman in charge of the Camera Catalonia programme over the festival, to discuss the films that have been screened and are going to screen, the Catalonian identity in their cinema, and, to begin with, a little bit of info on the film... Oh, hang on, I haven't finished... And also the link between the nationality's surrealism and the current inventiveness that you can see in the new cinema.
Deep, easy breath. Let your mind float into space.
There are two that are linked by the subject of the Civil War, but they are two very different films. But there was an idea of having them together to have the different approaches, and one is Eyes on the Sky by Jesús Garay, which I really find very interesting because it mixes documentary, fake documentary, and fiction, and it achieves probably a better result than if it was just a documentary. Whereas El Bosque, The Forest, approaches the subject from a much more conventional point of view. But in this case, what I like was it uses a script made from a short story by one of the most important Catalan writers nowadays, Albert Sánchez Piñol, and also because it approaches the issue of the Civil War instead of the very two very clearly defined sides. It shows more about one of the sides, which was the Republican side. Vigas Luna had to be in the program this year because sadly he died in April. And when he died, he was doing what was going to be a Catalan film in Catalan. And he was actually, I corresponded with him, and he was very enthusiastic about the project. It was a science fiction film by a Valencian writer, Manuel de Pedrolo. And he already had actors, and he was going to do it in 3D, which apparently was the format he wanted for Anguish. He wanted to shoot Anguish in 3D, to have the different levels of audience and film and theater, but it wasn't feasible then.
Is there a specific lexicon for surrealism in Catalan films and Catalan culture? It seemed to me that there was. It was a very specific form of expression. And what interested me is why that might be the case, whether it was something to do with the landscape, whether it was something to do with political suppression, or whether it was something to do at the time when Franco and that regime crushed Catalonian identity and autonomy, and whether or not the preservation of that is the preservation of the Catalonian culture in some way.
Interestingly, when surrealism appeared, it was the point of the maximum freedom Spain has had, probably, even compared to now. It was the whole of Spain, but in particular Catalonia and Barcelona. There was so much creativity at that point. I think you could dream, and Dalí dreamt. And so I would say that fascism crushed that spirit. As to why surrealism has continued, maybe because you like to keep dreaming in situations that are dreadful, but there would be part of the imaginary that exists. I don't know if it has to be also with the fact, like, the Catholic imaginary that is ever present, and it's got this dreamlike appearance sometimes. Or also the possibility to explain things in a way that's not very open.
I find it really interesting, this relationship between censorship and censors and surrealism. How surrealism is sometimes a film lexicon that can confuse and get past the censors quite often as well.
Yes, because luckily they are stupid enough not to notice these things. They certainly weren't at the time. The other problem Spain had is that the producers who would have the money, they wouldn't be keen to do any of these things. Although, for instance, Portabella produced Viridiana by Buñuel. So again, another link. And also, if we go back to the origins of cinema, you had in Catalonia, for instance, Segundo de Chamón, who was doing all these silent films with a lot of visual effects and dreamlike sequences, and there could be as well some of those influences we are talking about.
And we talked last night a little bit about the unified nature of Spain as a country, but its actual regional identities and where Catalonia fits into that. And you were saying that Catalonia looks towards Europe.
Yes, I think the main problem, and that's actually a current problem that still exists, is the fact that Spain was formed by several nations. It wasn't a completely peaceful agreement. It was more like dynastic marriages, and there was even war about who should be the king and how the state should be organized. And after many centuries, we are still on that. And also, we are still quarreling about if we are a multicultural, multinational society like Germany or Switzerland, or if we follow the French model. With cinema, it is very difficult because Catalan is spoken by 10 million people. So, you know, if you produce it in Spanish, you have all the South American markets. So from a commercial point of view, that's one of the reasons. And it is true what you said about looking towards Europe, not only culturally, but politically. There's always been this idea of progress. And that's why when the Civil War ended, all the intellectuals and artists like Pau Casals, they were shocked that the Europeans wouldn't help and wouldn't kick out the dictator. They couldn't believe. They felt hugely disappointed by the lack of support.
It's a very rare genetic change which causes unique shape with this kind of retinal activity. This is one of the rarest examples.
He's very sensitive to comments about his eyes. He's losing his vision.
Is there a sense that Catalonia, because of its precarious state and its want to be independent or want to have autonomy, is there a sense that it preserves its identity through its culture and particularly through its cinema?
This is actually something we discussed last year, and I said because of financial restrictions, there was a decision between TV and cinema, but both couldn't be. So the decision was to support TV, and it was a good decision because it's normalized society very much. In my suggestion, the next step would be to try to do something like Channel 4 or BBC would do, which already the Catalan TV is doing it, but is to commission more Catalan cinema. And actually, before we forget about surrealism, if I can, next year I'll bring what they consider to be fairly recent, from 2000 and something, surrealist film by Agustí Vila called La Mosquitera, The Mosquito Net. And it's a full-fledged feature, 1.5 hours. But yes, plenty of surreal elements, and many people can see Buñuel there. So hopefully we'll see it.
I really can't take this anymore. Please, let's go.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Ramon for the interview and to Steve, who was basically requested by me to recall the discussion I've been captivated by before on the night before in the Picture House bar. There are two more chances to see Catalonian films at the festival. The Forest screens tonight. He quickly turns to the Catalonian page of his brochure after being horrifically underprepared. You can see The Forest tonight at 9 p.m. and that is at the Arts Picture House, and it is well worth seeing. That is quite excellent. And there is a chance to see The Redemption of the Fish, which has had some of the best reviews of the festival, tomorrow, 29th, at 10:45 a.m. And again, that is at the Arts Picture House. It is an accidental custom that, as the Cambridge Film Festival draws to a close, the strangeness creeps in. Gone are the optimistic messages of the openers. In their place steps the lunacy of Project Trident, which had its annual showcase of shorts last night, the outright terror of the Cineworld Fright Fest screenings, and the missing links and forgotten glamour of the micro-cinema strand. Last year, micro-cinema was concerned with the new experimenters in film like Savage Witches, but this year it is looking back to the forgotten voices of Anthony Black and John Sampson. Just before the first screening of Microcinema on Thursday, I had a brief talk with the programmers for this year's series of films, James Mackay and William Fowler. I asked them for more details on the work showing, including Anthony Block's Horror Hospital and his film cut-up work with William Burroughs, and the slice of Secret Life caught by John Sampson's work. But first, I asked James Mackay what the underlining theme of the screenings was.
A darkened hospital room. A hand reaches in. A life-giving machine is unplugged at Hara Hospital.
Generally, it's capturing some of the kind of zeitgeist in the 70s when people were actually making films without going through all the sort of complex funding hoops and censorship rituals that you get now. And it was a very rich and diverse film culture. And this maybe represents, I'd call it a kind of eccentric fringe, but it's not really eccentric, it's very serious work. And it has, across all of it, a sense of expressive freedom, which I think is lacking now. And the idea of the weekend is to just try and recapture some of that sensibility and show people that there was a kind of alternative, which wasn't just an underground cinema, but was, you know, films playing to sort of mainstream audiences, but with a different quality than you might think looking back at feature films that were released at the time.
I'm curious about the distribution landscape in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, because this was a time when art house was shown by side with exploitation.
Yes, OK, no, but there were more cinemas, there were more screens, and there were more independent screens. And I think that's what's really missing now. There are very few independent screens, so it's difficult to get a broad showing of films. It's much narrower now. And I was just talking to Will, we were talking about the Edie Levy, which was a very kind of, it was like a subsidy for filmmakers, but it was very broad. You could, anybody could practically apply for it. You probably know more about it than I do, Will.
Yeah, so there was a quota that prevented American films dominating the cinema market. So basically a certain amount of British films had to be shown in the cinema, and if they went over a certain length, they qualified to recoup some of the box office return. So it was a way of maintaining British film production, and it ran until the early 80s when Margaret Thatcher put an end to it. So there was a kind of economic structure that helped shorter, sort of low-key independent films to be made. And I think what's also key about the 1970s, sort of carrying on from what James is saying, is that it sort of seems obvious, but this is, you know, before VHS, before people were able to rent films at home, and there was only three channels on TV. So, you know, there was much more hunger, I suppose, for a more diverse form of cinema experience. And I suppose in a way, maybe things hadn't been driven into niches so much, so different types of films would kind of rub up against each other in the way you're saying about how art house and more exploitation types of filmmaking kind of having more of a relationship with each other. I mean, someone told me the story that a nudist film ran with Ingmar Bergman films.
I don't know which one of you would be best for this, but give a little bit on the background of the John Sampson film that are screening, because they are very intriguing.
Well, I came across them when I was running the cinema at the Filmmakers Co-op in the late 70s. At film school, they made a film called Dressing for Pleasure, which is, of course, now a cult film. And it, you know, it is really amazingly beautiful, quirky look at people who fetishize clothing. Everybody from Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood in their boutique in the King's Road to members of the Macintosh Society. And it's very kind of English. It's a very English sensibility.
The subject matter, no matter how esoteric or subculture that eventually would be called, it seems, because it's so much of a celebration rather than a truthful portrayal of it, I actually felt that you could draw a line from it back to Humphrey Jennings and that sort of style of documentary. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think you're right. They're very much a celebration of things.
Yeah, I mean, it celebrates all different elements of British culture, the subjects they chose to focus on, the way that James was saying, but I think also there isn't a sort of didactic narration telling you what these people are doing and why. It's sort of allowing images to unfold in an engaging and often playful way and allowing people to have their own response whilst sort of crafting and shaping it along the way. And it's rare that you see films like that today. I think, you know, you're so often told exactly what this is about, what you should be thinking, reminded every 5 minutes. I mean, I suppose this is more TV really than cinema.
Lock them out and bar the door. Lock them out forevermore.
Could you just say a little bit about the three Burroughs-linked films that you have screening on Sunday?
Okay, so The Cut-Ups and Towers Open Fire were made by Anthony Bouch, who also made Horror Hospital, and he was friends with William Burroughs going back to the Beat Hotel in Paris where they first met. And both films are informed by the sort of literary techniques that Burroughs was exploring in his writing at the time that had been kind of pioneered by Brian Gyson. And I mean, I think, you know, those films are typically credited to William Burroughs more than Anthony Bouch, whereas I think Bouch actually had a very strong intuitive filmmaking sensibility, and they're very much collaborations, I think. And he, you know, as we said, Bouch was a cinema manager, and he would show these films before, you know, exploitation features. So audiences were really confused and confronted by them. And they're a sort of narrative, but they're very experimental.
Things get forgotten. And so it's really important, I think, for people to keep looking and find these works from the past. And the quite recent past, I think. That's the long past, as we'll tell you, is, you know, that's kind of being looked at all the time, but it's somehow the 70s and even the early 80s just kind of disappeared very quickly.
Film cinema started out as popular culture, and, you know, the language was progressing in the sense of forward movement and moving on to the next thing, and then people had to fight to say that certain filmmakers were the masters of their craft and should be held up above anything else, and along the way, other interesting things have been ignored, which maybe weren't fully appreciated at the time, almost in this attempt to hold on to these precious auteurs who have stolen attention away from other people who are, you know, also deserving, maybe more deserving.
Many thanks to James Mackay and William Fowler for allowing me to grab a few minutes of their time just as they arrived at the festival and were preparing for the first microcinema screening. The whole kit and caboodle began on Thursday evening with the screening of Horror Hospital, a 1973 black comedy horror that beats Hammer and Amicus at their own gory game. Robin Asquith, a few years before it became the famous bottom of the Confessions series of softcore pornography, plays a musician who heads for a health farm in the countryside, only to discover it's really the home of a mad scientist played by Michael Goff. Before you know it, the film's lean running time is crowded with screaming damsels in distress, leather-clad heavies, hippie zombies, and decapitating limousines. Mark, both James Mackay and William Fowler mentioned in the interview we've just played the need to shine light, microcinemas need to shine light on directors and films that time and cinema history has forgotten. Are you pleased in just this one incident you've had a chance to see Anthony Bloch's Horror Hospital?
Thrilled. It's a fantastic piece of entertainment, but it's also a unique piece of British cinema history. I think it goes a level beyond the sort of the initial camp thrills of the likes of Robin Asquith put into the kind of Horror Hospital setting. Michael Goff's performance is probably one of his best in his career. Whenever he's on screen, there's a definitive air of menace. But, you know, as someone who grew up on watching late night Hammer horrors and Amicus horrors with his mother late on Friday nights with the lights turned off, you know, this brought back lots of fantastic memories of youth. But, you know, it's such a shame that elements like this have been almost lost, and but for the efforts of the likes of William Fowler and people in his following would probably be completely lost to us.
I'm bewildered by this. I was expecting to enjoy, and in fact I've enjoyed the rest of the microcinema, which is completely different. John Sampson's stuff's extraordinary, but that's a different league than this. I expected just a funny, a bit of enjoyable cheap horror, like Hammer fell into towards in the late 60s when they were trying to compete with American exploitation in a way. But I just found this so poor. It was dull. I mean, when even you can't even there's a level of creativity that you could that doesn't cost any money, and this doesn't even have that. I don't mind the fact that it cost very, very little, and the acting's poor. It's so devoid of ideas of anything interesting at all that there was nothing to watch. I'm bewildered. I'm
going to take completely opposite view because there's as many ideas in it as work that don't, but it's never short of them. It's in fact it's almost got an attention deficit disorder in terms of the level of different elements that it's throwing at the screen.
I think you're misjudging the intelligence of it by calling them ideas. I think it's just stuff to fill the film out. It reminded me, oddly, of the episodes of Family Guy or The Simpsons where there's a big fist fight, simply because they haven't got enough story to fill out the 20 minutes. There's two huge fights in this, two big, melees, hand-to-hand fights, combat in this film, which I laughed long and hard at because I realised they were just filling time because they didn't have enough story to make a feature-length film. And it had all the horrible traits of... I'm so sad of watching Dennis Price, not in a horror film, that's fine, I don't think there's any come down in that, but playing this usual camp, lecherous old queen of a travel agent that he plays at the beginning, and that's such a tired stereotype. Even then it was cheap and nasty and not cheap and nasty in an interesting and entertaining way, like it might have been if it had been Italian, maybe. I mean even the Foley footsteps didn't match the pace. They were at a different pace than the walking in the castle. I love the microcinema strand, and it's some of the most fascinating and interesting stuff in the festival for me. And certainly the Burroughs material that's screening tomorrow and the John Sampson stuff that was on yesterday is wonderful, and last year's material was wonderful, but this is hokey without any redeeming features. I think the authors and writers have worked themselves up in a frenzy about nothing here.
for me it was a guilty pleasure, frankly, if that's a judgment on me, it's one I'm more than happy to take.
I think it's probably a judgment on joyless me as well. Okay, all right. The microcinema season continues at the festival today and tomorrow with screenings at 6:15 tonight of John Pierce's Movie Makers, a Requiem for the King's Road, Swinging and Seedy 60s. And on Sunday evening, there's a rare chance to see the William Burroughs narrated version of the 1922 Danish silent Huxon, A Story of Witchcraft, rated 18. It is 76 minutes of some of the strangest early cinema ever created. You can find out more about the microcinema season on page 36 and 37 of the festival programme. We will be back in a fortnight's time, but don't forget you can find out all our festival broadcasts and podcasts on a special page on the Cambridge 105 website. We'll be back on October the 12th with the Fifth Estate and Sunshine on Leith and a few other things, as well as interviews.